Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 4th, 2006. Today's session is entitled, The Dangers of a Hopeless Life, Matthew 24, verses 45 through 51, presented by Michael Pallett, number PO-M-2006-13. Let's listen in.
Welcome to our apocalyptic morning. As you can see, I've tried to provide you with a kind of day of judgment setting. The deep thunder clouds, lightning. Hopefully there won't be much more darkness descending upon us, but we'll see what happens. My name again is Michael Pallett, and I'm leading the Bible study this week. I teach at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon, and I'm also a Lutheran pastor at one of the churches there in Saskatoon. And this week, what we're doing is looking at some of the passages in Matthew's Gospel, particularly the seven parables that are at the end of Matthew chapter 24, and then going into chapter 25 that talk about the end of the world. But, as I was trying to talk about yesterday, that if we want to talk about the end of the world and get an understanding of that from Matthew's perspective, we have to read that in the light of the end of Matthew's Gospel. And so what we're doing is looking at sections, and again, we started yesterday with chapter 32, and if we're lucky, we'll get today to verse 51, but probably we'll only get to verse 33. No, we're past that one. But what we want to do is look at this section in the light of Matthew 28, 16 to 20. So it's Matthew 28, 16 to 20, if you will, are the glasses through which we were reading, or we are reading, chapters 24 and 25. Now, why is that? The reason that is because of our theme for the summer. Matthew's gospel ends with Jesus' assurance. I am with you always to the end of the age. And so if we have that sense of Christ's presence with us always to the end of the age, what does that mean when we talk about the end? Because we have the sense that Jesus is always already here with us. So what would the end or the coming of Jesus mean again? What does that mean, as I like to put it, in terms of living between the two resurrections, the resurrection of Jesus and our own resurrection? And I think that's what Matthew is talking about in these two chapters, chapters 24 and 25. Given the presence of Jesus with us, how do we live between those two resurrections? And as we started talking yesterday, I think as we begin some of these parables, the talk here about the end and how to understand it in this section is with two key words. That the end is imminent, near, always just about to happen, and it's incalculable. You can't figure it out, you can't plan, you can't predict, you can't model when it will happen and what kind of scenario that might be. If you put imminent and incalculable together, I think what we're talking about here is the notion of contingency. Because contingencies are always those things that break into our lives that we don't plan for. Today is a good example of that, as we've got the whole schedule for the 4th of July and all of those things we planned for, but we really didn't plan to have the rain and the weather. And indeed, that gives us our first notion of hope. Because this notion of hope is that in our present, like a week ago, as folks started talking about, the future, the end, the telos, the 4th of July presentation, we knew that we could bring about the 4th of July. That can be our project and our project. I mean, just read the schedule on the board. The 4th of July is a done deal. What we were hoping is that it won't rain, so that we can eat outside and have things outside and all those other things, right? Those were the contingencies. These are the contingencies that kind of mess us up. So our normal way of hoping is we usually hope that whatever contingencies might happen would be removed so they don't mess up the end, the plan, the goal, which we know we can achieve if only something doesn't come in to mess it up. But that's not the biblical view of hope. The biblical view of hope, or as Paul calls it, hope against hope, is that we think about things from the future. We think about God's promises to us and how that indeed those promises seem to be impossible. And I used as the illustration here, Abraham and Sarah. When God promises to Abraham and Sarah, I'll make you a great nation, and all the nations of the earth will be blessed through you. But of course, that future would depend on Abraham and Sarah having a child. Now, how does 80-year-old barren Sarah have a child? That end, that future seems impossible. And yet God says that that impossibility will be possible. And God, if you will provide the contingencies that make the impossible possible. So that future, that promise, advents or comes toward us in our present. So just as God makes it possible for Abraham and Sarah to have a child, to become a great nation through whom all nations are blessed, so too, as we talk about the end, that end with God's promise, how does that happen? It will happen through the contingencies, the possibilities that God, that Christ provides as God, Christ, continues to come toward us with God's presence, with Christ's presence, and enables us then to live that impossible possibility already in our present. And so that's what Matthew's trying to get at in these parables. How do we live the impossible, which God can make possible already in the present? And so yesterday we started in verse 32 of chapter 24 to look at the parable of the fig tree. And understanding again from that fig tree the notion of how it signals summer. Signals the time of harvest and God's coming. And from that, we had discussions about what it means to disciple, to learn, to direct one's mind to something, and how that sense of discipling here is always the way in which the community of Jesus focuses itself on Jesus. And indeed, in doing that, we understand that it is God's reign and rule that is coming. And so while heaven and earth can pass away, all the kinds of governance structures and human controls that might come up, whether they are social, political, and religious, they will pass away. But what remains is God's word. Again, going back to chapter 28, Jesus' commission to us that we are to teach all the things that Jesus has taught us, that Jesus has commanded us. And so that's the first sense, and in that parable of the fig tree, that's one of the key things to learn in terms of how we live this life of the present. We're going to move on now and look at the parable of the flood. This is in chapter 34, verses 36 through 41. And so if someone would please read chapter 24, verses 36 through 41, so that we get a sense and hear for the first time what this is about.
But about that day and hour, no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. For as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away, so too will be the coming of the Son of Man.
Keep going.
Then two will be in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, one will be taken and one will be left.
Okay, thank you. That's the parable that's there. As we start with verse 36, we already seem to have a problem. It says there that about the day and hour, no one knows. No human being, no angels, not even the Son of Man. And in Matthew, that's a reference to Jesus himself. Now, up until now, it seems as if Jesus knew something, because after all, his disciples ask him, when is all of this going to happen? And he starts telling them things about when all of this is going to happen. And now, here we are, three quarters of the way through the chapter, and now he says, well, you know, I don't know. What are we to make of that? That not even Jesus knows.
It's the Father's decision.
It's the Father's decision, okay.
And he hasn't really told us all along here when, as in a time in history, it was going to happen, or a day or an hour. He's just been sort of telling the disciples, these are things that are going to happen that you need to be awake and watchful for. He didn't say, you know, Monday at 2 o'clock, have your things packed. So.
That's right. In terms of the when, Jesus never did say a day or an hour. So there might be some consistency there.
It's more about just paying attention.
So we need to pay attention. Any other ideas about why Jesus says, I don't know?
Because it's contingent.
It's contingent? Yeah. Yes.
It hadn't been set yet. Perhaps the time hasn't been set.
The time hasn't been set?
In a sense, he's saying, don't even worry about it. I'm not worried about it, so you shouldn't be either.
Right? There's a notion of don't worry about it. All of those things are in there. I think there's one more thing that's in here. And that Matthew wants Jesus not to know for kind of a polemical reason. In the beginning of chapter 24, Jesus always warns us about all these false teachers. And all these false teachers are saying, I know when the end is coming. I know the day and the hour. And so on the one hand, Matthew would say, really? If Jesus doesn't know that, what would ever lead us to think that one of these folks would know it? And even further, the claim might be, well, you know, last night I had a dream, and I saw a 900-foot Jesus. And this 900-foot Jesus told me that on July 4th, 2006, at 10:45 a.m., will come the end of the world. But now we can say, I don't think so. Because if Jesus doesn't know when it's coming, how could Jesus tell me when it's coming? You see, I just made that up. So that, again, I think this is one of Matthew's ways of telling us, beware of all those false teachers, or when anyone goes around saying, I know when, I know when, I know when, don't you believe it. Because if Jesus doesn't know, for sure, these folks don't know.
Michael, this is one of my favorite verses to remember where it is when the folks knock on the door with their pamphlets that they want me to learn about their particular faith that says when the end of the world is coming, and that's all they want to talk about. And I all pull out my Bible and read this verse. I say, I go with Jesus.
And what do they say?
They leave.
They leave. Okay, well, yeah. I mean, they don't have much to say after that, do they? But I think that's one of the key reasons for why that is in here. And then once we have that, Jesus tells us again about the story of Noah, and here he's using Noah as a parable, and he wants to parallel the days of Noah with our own days. So we've got Noah, and somehow that's going to be parallel to our days. Now, what's the parallel? What parallels do you see in those next few verses? Let's say as we look, where is it here? At verses 37 through 39. So those three verses, 37, 38, 39, that's the parable of Noah. What's the parallel between Noah's days and our days? They're unprepared. What else?
Marrying and giving in marriage.
Yeah, so
living
what? Yeah, they're just kind of, right? They're living normal lives.
And blissful ignorance.
Blissful ignorance. You can say they're, if I could spell, they are absorbed in the ordinary. I gotta pick the kids up from school, and then we go to music lessons, and then there's basketball practice, and then I got my meeting at church tonight, and then, oh, we'll stop at McDonald's for something to eat, and you know. What other parallels might there be?
Noah didn't know either, but he was getting prepared.
Noah didn't know, but he was getting prepared. So that there's one sense of preparation that's going on.
Yeah.
Any other parallels that you see between Noah and our own day, or the day here with Jesus?
The two.
What?
The two.
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 One is taken, but two are left.
So there's two left. Two get to go on. Two men get to go on. Two women get to go on. And the same with...
No. Oh, no.
No, it's two are in the field, one is taken and one is left.
Yeah, but then two are grinding and one is taken and one's left. So of those four, two get to stay, two get to go.
All right. Anyway.
All right.
Still a math problem.
I'll put down two, but my editorial comment, that's a stretch.
Yeah.
I got more if you want.
I'll say something different about the taken and left behind stuff in a
Noah
minute.
Noah was asked to do the sun was shining, and he was asked to do the impossible, which means he had to trust that whatever God asked him to do was going to come to pass.
Yeah, it's as we're talking about here, this is an illustration of how one lives out this notion of hope against hope. I mean, think of the comments Noah must have received from his neighbors.
They probably thought he was nuts.
That's right.
Well, just like if somebody, just what you were saying about, you know, if somebody starts saying, well, there's a big flood coming and we're all going to be swept away, so I'm building an ark and we better get ready, and we are all going to say, yeah, right. But before this, Jesus was saying, you're not supposed to believe these people who tell you they know when it's coming. So that's a little confusing. Because Noah, apparently, God did tell Noah, and Noah did build the ark because on God's word. But now we're not supposed to really pay too much attention to the when. And so if somebody started building a big boat or something to take us to heaven or a church or a doctrine or something.
Indeed, Noah built the ark. But did he go around and tell everybody else, you know, this is what's going to happen, this is what's going to come? Or did he just simply do what he was told? He told his family. His family helped him. But he just simply lived differently.
Right?
I think, you know, we can say unprepared, living normal lives, blissful ignorance. A word I would put in here is a notion of indifference.
I think the point she makes is valid, though. There's an absurdity in Noah's trust.
Yeah.
And what's the difference between his absurdity and the absurdity of Jehovah's Witnesses today? It says it is going to happen.
Okay, well, what do you think, John, is the difference? Use your word because that will help me play with that. Absurd literally means, for something to be absurd literally means that you're deaf. You're dull or deaf toward something. That's absurdity. When you say it's a The opposite of absurd is obedience. Abaudirin means that you hear toward or you listen. So that in that sense, while from our perspective one might say Noah is absurd in everything he does, and he's just as absurd as somebody else, one would say, no. When we look at what Noah is doing, we would not categorize that as absurd, but crazily enough, it's obedience. Noah hears what God is saying, which again characterizes our sense of living in terms of hope against hope. To an indifferent, blissfully ignorant, absorbed in the ordinary world, the life of the community of faith may indeed seem absurd. But we're making the claim it's obedience, because we hear Christ's word. We hear Christ's teaching. Because after all, let's go back to the Sermon on the Mount and pick one of those crazy things, love your enemies. That seems to be absurd at first, doesn't it? But we hear that and follow. Yes, please.
It goes back to your future into the present. What seems impossible is possible. Building an ark in your backyard seems really stupid and impossible. But
yeah.
Since it's based on God's promise, it's actually the right thing to do.
Yeah. But see, you don't know that ahead of time. That's that. You're right there, both of you. That's where that absurdity comes in, because you don't know that ahead of time. But I think one wants to categorize that finally as obedience. That given Jesus' word, no matter how absurd that sounds, we trust the promise, we're obedient. Right?
Isn't it true that all the way through the prophets and Jesus are holding up this marvelous notion that if you have ears, you have to use them to listen, and listening to God, and that all many of these modern contradictory movements that we know about apparently are listening to each other and to the word of man, not the word of God, and they set aside and marginalize the teachings of Jesus in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't following and obeying. They're making it up as they go along.
But that's not what they think they're doing. I mean, I think they probably think they are. They're interpreting it in a certain way, but they just believe it. And they think it's their job to make you believe it too. Most of them, I don't think it's a plot. I think they really believe it. It's that way.
Sincerely.
So we just believe it a different way.
Could Noah's hearing be an additive thing? That he hears God's word in addition to? Because I'm wondering if he lived a normal life to some extent and still built the ark. I mean, eating and drinking. And the reason I say that is after the flood, the first thing he did is planted a vineyard and got drunk. But prior to the deluge, was he still living somewhat integrated with life and, in addition, hearing God?
Well, I imagine when his sons were married, he had a wedding celebration and things like that. But again, I guess I would just see it more holistically, that there are ways of doing that within the notion of obedience as well. I mean, I don't know. One other point, and this is, again, pushing the text pretty hard. When it talks about the folks there in the time of Noah were eating and drinking, that word for eating there in Greek is the word trogo, which literally means munching. It's the word used to describe the way in which a cow or something would chew their cud. And usually within that context, that kind of eating or munching is talking about, I guess today we would say it kind of a phrase like, they were pigging out, or they were porking out. I guess within the Jewish context, we would say they were beefing out or something. We don't want to bring pork into that. But right, you get that sense that they're really kind of guzzling it down. The parallel for us in our day, we might understand that as how the ordinary life now is one that is consumed by consumption. Right? And so they're just consuming their way through life and all that it has to offer. Right? And in that sense, in their ignorance, ignoring what is going to happen and the issues that are there. And then comes the flood, the cataclysm, the calamity, and it sweeps them away, right? They are totally unprepared, and the disaster follows. Verses 40 and 41 then try to amplify that in terms of, using an example of from the male world of work, and the female world of work, right? Two men are working in the field, one's taken, one's left. Two women grinding meal, one's taken, one's left. Now, obviously, this is again a passage that some are going to use to say, well, see, look at, here's the rapture. But with our way of talking and with their way of talking back then, taken away or taken from is not a sense of rapture. If I were to announce to you this morning to say, well, I have some news for you. Jeannie Olson has been taken from us. What would that mean?
She died.
Right?
Or captured.
Huh?
Or captured.
Or captured. Yeah, she could be captured. But most of us, when we use that, you know, someone has been taken from us, one of our loved ones has been taken away, we're talking about death. We're not talking about the rapture, and usually we're not talking about kidnapping or something like that, right? It's an understanding of death. And certainly within the history of the interpretation of this passage, again, going back to some of the earliest interpretations we have of it from people like Origen and going through Chrysostom, Augustine, and all of Luther, right on up until the 19th century when this rapture stuff came into vogue, no one interprets these two verses in any other way than talking about the sudden, surprising ways of death. Right. Here you are working along, and suddenly one of your colleagues is taken from you. Right. Death can happen at any time. That's the surprise. Yes, please.
Two verses previous, in verse 39, it talks about the flood taking them all away. Is that the same verb? Same.
They were just swept away. Yeah.
So it's not like a rapture.
It's no rapture there at all. It's talking about the surprise of the end of one's life that always comes upon us, and certainly back then, let's say even more than now, where we have a bit better way of diagnosing some of these things. I mean, death so often comes as a surprise. But I would say for us as well, at least existentially, right? Even when diagnosed with something.
Like a tsunami.
Tsunamis or anything. Death still is that sense of surprise.
I think this is the thing that causes possibly problems under the verb then. Or not the verb, I'm sorry, then. Because it says the becoming of the sun, I don't believe this is the rapture kind of thing, but what I'm saying is that it says the flood took them all away, and it says then shall, you know, it sounds like it's the result of, as opposed to just a...
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying. Okay. This was part of last week. We talked about then. Last week. Then is a favorite word for Matthew. Matthew uses the word then 90 times in his gospel, where the other gospels, you know, Mark uses it 6 times, Luke, I think, 11. So he likes the word then. And for Matthew, when he talks about then, it's always a signal of saying, okay, now I'm moving on to another idea, or I'm looking at it from a different angle. So that the then is not always a connective, but to say, okay, here's the next step in the argument, here's a new angle of looking at it and that. And it said also earlier in chapter 24, as he talks about the coming of the end, he uses the word for labor pains. And the way in which he uses the word then is indicative, I would say, of the sense of contractions. So the woman goes into labor, then, first contraction, then, Right? I mean, we keep getting all of these contractions, these labor pains that brings about the birth of the end.
Yes. What is the Greek word
for what? For then. Labor pains?
No, then.
For then?
Is that yar?
Huh?
Is that yar?
No, it's tota. T-O-T-E.
Okay.
For Matthew, if you see the word gar.
Gar.
Yeah, G-A-R, that would usually be translated so or therefore.
Or it wouldn't however.
It wouldn't mean or however, but it wouldn't mean then. Matthew's sense of then is T-O-T-E.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, Michael, partly what you're pointing to here is that the then is not causative. But when
correct.
We read this, we're, of course, curious. Who gets taken? Who doesn't get taken? Why is that? Is it you're taken as judgment or you're taken as reward, to make it extreme? And then the second thing that comes into our interpretation is whether we're reading this as a parable or as a prediction. Right? So you say we're reading Noah as a parable. It's very different than reading it as prediction.
Right. And so it's not causative. It's not a parable, or it's not a prediction. It's a parable. We're not given any reason why one is taken or not. I mean, the point of that is, you know, you died.
And it can happen
any time. Right? That's the sense of any day, any hour, you could die.
I think there's a strong element in the modern aberrations, like you said, came in the 1900s or whatever, that promote fear. The idea is that we're in the last days, it's going to happen real soon, to promote fear, whereas I think Matthew and Jesus' rendition here is to promote hope. Because a good thing is going to happen. You're going to be, the Lord is coming once again.
I have a question.
Yes.
Okay, so I've always interpreted all this kind of end days kind of stuff as being about my life. You know, the end is going to come. I don't know when I'm going to drop dead or what's going to take me or how. And so I need to pay attention to how Jesus said this is the way to be one with God and one with your fellow human beings, and because you don't know when you're going to go, so you may have only this many days. Pay attention, do the best you can. So what the question I have is, why does it also have to be about the end of the world? I've never really read it. I mean, I know that's the way it's supposed to, you know, be end, but I've never really thought that made any difference. It didn't make any difference to me. So why does it have to be both? Why isn't it just about our lives and how we live our lives?
Because I think it's the sense there, the distinction folks would make to say that's the existential side of it. And you're right about all of that, and that certainly is the one major strand that's here in Matthew. The other side of that would be to come back with the question in terms of, is the end of you the end of everything?
No, but it's just the end of my part in it, what I can do to affect it one way or the other, or have any...
Right.
The end of my bringing God into the world.
Right.
That's the end of my piece. Everyone else has to keep going with their pieces of bringing God into life. But
So that would then mean, how do we talk about that other notion of the end as well? In other words, the end would be more inclusive than just simply the end of your life or the end of my life. In other words, it's more than just the existential side to it, because there's more to the end than just my end.
So an idea that there will eventually be an end to it all, that as we know it or something. Life on the earth, or it's the end of what? Just the end of
Well, from Matthew linking that up, the end is linked up with a sense of resurrection. That there is more.
All the souls that have gone before will rise up and become one with God or something.
That's one way, but it's the sense here that Matthew's claim, Jesus' claim, is that there is more to life, there is more to history than just kind of a chronological end. Uh-huh. Right? We're talking about some sense of completion, fulfillment, whatever that might be, right? One of that is rising from the dead, becoming totally, fully, completely one, joined with God, whatever. I mean, I think at this point, it becomes very abstract.
Yeah.
I mean, the common thread through it all is that the end somehow is how we are all brought totally and completely into the presence of God.
How about a new beginning?
It can be a new beginning, but that again would be defined in, or understood in terms of that in the presence of God. Right.
But what he's really driving towards the imperative, it seems to me, Jesus, is the whole thing is based on the word watch.
Yeah.
If all this stuff that happened with Noah, that's what it's going to be like, watch. And as you said yesterday, if the end is already accomplished and it imposes itself on the present, then what Jesus is telling us to do is look for it. Don't miss it in your daily experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Watch, listen, you know, are you hearing it? Are you seeing it? Right? I can say now in this class, keep awake! Be on the alert. That, of course, is the verse 42, right? The whole point of both of these parables is be on the alert. Keep awake. Let's move a little bit here into the next parable. This is verses 43 and 44. Would someone read that for us, please?
But understand this. If the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour.
Okay. So how do you interpret that parable? Be ready. But how can you be ready? How can you be always alert and on your guard so the thief won't break in? Are you going to be awake 24/7?
Rough.
Huh?
That's rough.
Yeah, that's rough. That's not going to work.
That's not going to work.
Could not have anything for him to steal.
Don't have anything for him to steal. Yeah, that might be an interesting way to look at that. Get an alarm system. No. Any other notions? What's here? How does verse 44 help you understand this? Therefore, you also must be ready. Let me give you a literal Greek sense on that one. See if this will confuse you even more. Jesus is saying here, be becoming ready ones. So how do you be becoming ready ones? How are you a ready one?
Well, maybe it's back to that love thing that we were talking about before. If I'm constantly sort of arming myself with love by being in community and reading the Bible maybe and praying and doing, you know, I can't be surprised by these other things that happen, because every response will always be a love response, and nothing will, I don't know.
Okay.
Knocked me over.
But you think you won't be surprised?
Well, I might be surprised, but I'm still ready because I have this center that doesn't get knocked over as easily as it would if I was just reacting like, oh, I hate you for doing that, and well, I'll get you back. If I have the love response always as much as humanly possible, then I'm not broken into as easily.
Over here to Kate, and then.
Well, it's just interesting because when you write it out on the board, the difference, I mean, just sort of with the words is that in the therefore you also must be ready, it seems like the readiness is a, if you could just get into this one state of being awake constantly, it's a final state that you reach. But in that, the becomingness is always a process, that it's always happening, that it's not just that you get to a point and then you're ready, it's that you always have to be trying to get to that place in yourself, that it's a process rather than a final ending point.
Right, yeah, I mean, for all you grammarians, this is a present imperative, not an aorist, so that means it's not the final state, but it's the continuous, you know, I mean, you could even go, keep on being becoming ready ones, right? It's that sense there of, we'll go Frank and then we'll go over here.
To me, it's always maintaining an attitude of awareness that God is with us. God is always with us.
Always that awareness?
Yeah, please.
Well, maybe it, you can't keep the thief away because you can't stay awake 24 hours. But the point is, even when the thief comes or when you get terribly sick or your loved one dies, you're still ready because God's with you.
Mm-hmm. We'll go over here to these two and then over here.
When Katrina and Rita hit our Gulf Coast area, we knew they were coming. There was no plan. And so New Orleans goes under, and they try to evacuate 4 million people out of Houston. But it was a disaster, to go 3 miles in 24 hours. You know, they were stuck. Since that time, New Orleans is doing what it can. And in Houston, their drills are happening. Gas trucks and so, I mean, we're becoming ready ones. When the next hurricane hits metropolis of 4 million people, that's my sense of what's going on here. Now that we know for sure things are going to happen again, we are really more ready than we've ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What I was going to say sort of encourages that thought too is that Jesus sets this parable up at the very beginning. He says, "If you knew the hour." In other words, you do know the hour. You know exactly what's going on. You know, in what we talked about yesterday, we know the result of God's saving activity. So how do we deal with that? And the way I like to think of it is, it's a word that's been kind of stolen by the New Age thinkers, but mindfulness, you know, that's something that is constantly present on your mind so that you won't miss it in the next event that happens in front of you. It might be a person asking you for help, or you know, it might be a simple conversation, but mindful of the death and resurrection of Christ, we see that person differently. Later on, he gives the opposite of what being a ready one is, but he thinks that my master's staying away a long time, and he begins to feed his fellow servants and eat and drink with drunkards.
Oh, you're looking ahead. That's cheating. But you're right. I mean, that there's the opposition there of being a ready one. Yes, please.
Well, it's kind of a different angle, maybe, but you may hear this about constantly, but I would say that none of us are constantly anything. I mean, and so that kind of, that makes me think about, okay, how does that relate to, say, God's grace versus readiness? Because maybe one time I slip up or something, or I'm not ready, and the end comes, what then? I mean, surely there's got to be God's grace that blankets that overall thing. So I don't know where I'm going with that exactly, just to start to throw that out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
The language at the end of the line is, because the Son of Man will come.
at an hour when you do not expect. You guys are all talking, hopefully, like you're going to be on top of it and be ready when he comes, but that's thrown up as a challenge that no matter what you do, he's going to surprise you. It's a challenge. Matthew's saying, there's no way.
Yeah.
I wonder about whether it's an individual thing or whether, in fact, it's community. One of the ways that we can be ready is to help each other. I mean, to be alone is almost impossible, but in community, when one is tired, another one can step in. So maybe this is becoming ready ones. Maybe the idea of being in community is a way to be most ready.
I think that's a both and for Matthew, right? The sense here is, again, existentially, individually, be ready, but also this is an address to the community of faith, and so it's as a community, be ready. Just, you know, the New Orleans, the Houston example, right? It's not just, okay, as long as the mayor of Houston is ready, we're okay. No, it's the whole community has got to be ready. And just one more, I mean, that sense here, as we've been talking about from the notion, I think what the thief parable is about is that, yes, you're going to be surprised, but don't be surprised that you're surprised. Because you will be surprised, but still be ready. I mean, I'll use a Holden example, right? The first response team, right? That somebody's out hiking and they injure themselves and what? And, you know, you're surprised. Oh, no, somebody will hurt them. But you're also ready then to respond. And so there's people who are on the first response team. Unlike myself, I'm on the last resort team. You know, the sense here is don't be on the last, you know, don't be so surprised that you kind of, as you say, you know, throw up, oh no, what am I going to do now? You know, to say, no, we are ready. We have what Jesus has told us in terms of how do we respond to these surprises with love, with the teachings of Jesus, what we have heard from him, and so we obey. And that enables us to be the ready ones when the surprise comes. And as you've said, that's right. And it will be a surprise. But we're ready. So there's that, again, there's that kind of tension there. But that's the way in which we are asked to respond. Okay, I cut you off.
No, it's okay. It just, everybody's things that they were saying sort of reminded me of the story of the Hebrews leaving Egypt, that they had to be ready to go as soon as Pharaoh said, "Guy, get it, go."
Yeah.
But they also had to go about their daily lives until that moment. You know, so the whole Passover thing with the bread on the back, and it's the same kind of thing, is you have to live and be ready to go.
Yeah, that's right. Eat that with your walking stick in your hand so you know you're ready to take that hike right away.
I always thought of the eating and drinking that the people around Noah were doing was that's all they did. They had no notion of anything except just their mundane eating, drinking, and partying.
No, well, that's kind of life today, isn't it?
Exactly.
Right? I mean, that's what we would call kind of that normal sense of life. And what it's about. All right, let's be daring here and move on to this last parable, verse 45, that talks about who is the faithful and wise slave. And again, gives us an illustration of what it is to be a ready one and not a ready one. And I want to preface this parable with a question. And that is, because it ends in such a brutal manner, right? Chop him to pieces. The word there is diachemeo. It basically, literally means, it says, dichotomize him. Right? Chop him in two. which is apparently an old Persian way of killing people, right? They would just chop them in two, and if they really didn't like you, they did it vertically. Right? So, here's my question. Does the absence of judgment make grace unreal? Or another way, is it not judgment which makes grace truly grace? Does the absence of judgment make grace unreal? Or another way of putting it, is it not judgment which makes grace really grace? I think at its deepest, that's where this parable is pushing us, wanting us to think that through. That's not an easy question. Let me read for you. This is from the Old Book of Common Prayer. And it's the Collect for Grace. And as you listen to this, think about this is usually not the way we would talk or pray about grace. The Collect for Grace from the old edition of the Book of Common Prayer, quote unquote, imprint upon our hearts such a dread of thy judgments, and such a grateful sense of thy goodness to us, as to make us both afraid and ashamed to offend thee. And above all, keep in our minds a lively remembrance of that great day, in which we must give a strict account of our thoughts, words, and actions to him whom thou hast appointed the judge of quick and dead, thy Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. And if you note there, it only has one sense of grace, a grateful sense of thy goodness to us. Everything else in this prayer talks about dread of thy judgments, make us both afraid and ashamed, a lively remembrance of that great day, a strict account of our thoughts, words, and actions to the one whom thou hast appointed judge. Lots of judgment talk in there. Only one phrase about grace, and yet this is called the Collect for Grace. But the bell is rung. It's time to eat.